Today, we're going to discuss the calculations for the molar volume of an ideal gas at STP. What's going to happen is I'll go over all the calculations here, and then I am going to be sending you a set of data that has two runs on it, two trials. And you won't be writing a full lab report. You will be doing just the calculations for the experiment, but you will be doing the calculations for the experiment. So the question was asked before class, which experiments do we have to worry about in terms of reports? This will be a partial one, and I'm going to describe everything that you have to do. Sean, do you have another question?
No, sorry, I'll put my hand down.
Okay, no problem. So, where I want to start is this diagram that came from the notes from the other day. And this is just a picture of what the experiment looks like after it's completed. And I want to just start out as the talking point. So, if you recall, in this experiment, what happens is the tube that's in the middle there, the eudiometer, gets filled up with first hydrochloric acid and water. And then there's a piece of magnesium tied to a stopper where the stopper has a hole in it. And, of course, the stopper is face up at first when you're filling it, but then you turn it upside down, covering the opening until you get it into this beaker, and then you allow the reaction to happen, because what will happen is the hydrochloric acid, being a little bit more dense, will fall down to the bottom eventually and start the reaction with magnesium metal. A bunch of bubbles happen. You end up with hydrogen gas in the top. That's what the gray shading is supposed to represent. The pink in that diagram is the magnesium before it reacts, so it shouldn't actually be there at the end. And then there's some other markings I've got here because there are several things that you're supposed to measure in the lab. So if I could just remind you that we're going to be using a PVT. Type of equation, P1V1 over T1 equals P2V2 over T2. To take the conditions that, in theory, you measured in lab, of course, it's a fake set of, well, not a fake set of data, it's just you didn't happen to take it. But you would measure pressure, volume, and temperature in the lab, and then adjust those to STP conditions. So that's why I've got the diagram labeled the way that I have. So V would be the volume of the gas, which you get directly from looking at the eudiometer. T is for temperature. And, of course, I might have already mentioned that there isn't the equipment in the lab for us to stick a type of probe up into the eudiometer as the reaction's going on. So we did the best that we could, which would be to measure the temperature right where the hole to the stopper is, because presumably whatever liquid is in contact with the gas would be at roughly the same temperature as that gas. At least that's the assumption that we're making, and it turns out to be good enough for our results. So the one thing that's not mentioned here is pressure. And that's because you don't measure it directly in this experimental setup. The pressure is just the surrounding atmospheric pressure. And if you might recall, there is a De Anza weather station on campus, which I'll actually show you the link for in just a moment. But here is the point of the discussion where we need to start with our calculations. Because the total pressure is not just the pressure of the hydrogen gas. There are two other adjustments that must be made. One that's easy to explain, and one that I got to. I won't say lost this morning. I don't think I was making the point as clearly as I could. So, and I just noticed it did stop. Wow. There we go. There. So, P total is equal to the pressure of hydrogen plus what I'm calling pH2O plus what I'm calling P height. Now, of course, the pH2O, that is the vapor pressure of water. And it turns out the only thing we have to look up is temperature. And there's two ways you can find, then, the vapor pressure of water. One way is that if you look in your experiment, which I just shared the iPad again, but let me go ahead and show you here. So now I'm going to the experimental procedure, and this is page three, I think it is. Yes. So on page three, you can see equation five. We're going to learn later on where this equation comes from. But right now, I'm just pointing out it's there, and it's a reasonable model for calculating vapor pressure. Now, vapor pressure is such a common thing that there are tons of tables generated just for the vapor pressure of water. So, in fact, if you give me just a moment, I'll show you an example. There we go. So you can see that in this table, the vapor pressure of water has been measured out to five significant figures, which that's awfully precise for a pressure. And, oh, question's being asked, what is vapor pressure? So vapor pressure is the fact that not all of the molecules in a liquid are traveling with the same speed. And so if there's enough energy in a certain fraction of those molecules, they'll be able to evaporate even if you haven't reached the true boiling point of that liquid. So any kind of liquid or any type of solid, technically as well, has what's known as a vapor pressure. For most solids, it might be almost non-existent. But for things like ice, you can have the vapor of water coming off of ice to some certain degree. Again, because of the fact that there's some fraction of molecules that might have the energy to do so. So it's related to kinetic molecular theory. And the vapor pressure that we're going to look for here is right at 25 degrees Celsius, which to 3 sig figs, is that good enough for us? Let me think. We should take it, yes, because science. Let's just take 3 sig figs for now. So on the table here, it is 23.8 at 25 degrees Celsius. So more of the point of showing this to you, I mean, I know you all could go to a website, but just explaining historically, lots of engineering is revolving around water. Water's in an awful lot of cooling systems, a lot of separations. So that's why there's so much data out there about water, and I just want to point that out. Okay, so let's go back to the notes now. Okay, so the vapor pressure of water can be calculated, and that's equation 5 from your lab text. Or obtained from a table. And I'm sure most of you may end up just using the equation because it's already there. But a table is perfectly acceptable as well. Now, that's talking about the vapor pressure of water. It's this P height that's a little bit more troublesome. So here's the point. And this is what I was referring to in lecture where I said, here's where you have to actually understand a little bit that whole discussion about heights of liquid and pressure. Because if you look at the light blue that's in the diagram there, that's representing the, I saw that in the chat window. If you look at that light blue, that is water that is above the surrounding liquid level that's in the beaker itself. But if you think about it, how can the water just be sitting there levitating, you could say, on its own? Well, it must be because, in fact, the pressure on the outside is greater than pressure on the inside. So it's like the pressure on the outside is forcing the liquid up into the tube. And so that's why we have this equation, that the total pressure is equal to these things put together. So the P height correction is to account for the fact that this weight of the water is translating into some of the pressure that is balancing the outside pressure. So let me write that part down, what I just said. So in this example, ignoring for the fact that I did show magnesium there, but that's because I wanted you to know how it's hooked up. So at the end of this experiment, the liquid level inside the eudiometer is above the level of the outside liquid. So this effectively means the pressure outside the eudiometer is greater than inside. And this difference is related to the weight of the water itself. And that's the water above the outside level. So, if you can remember that pressure is force over area, and then force, weight is a type of force, I'm just going to put that in a comment here. That's to help explain why this weight of water is related. Now, if I jump a little bit forward, because we went through this derivation the other day, and there was an equation I ended up with here, that pressure is equal to three variables. And so, just to remind you, G, that's the gravitational constant. So I'll just say gravity for short. That might make the physicists mad, but let them be mad. H, that's the height. The height of the column of liquid. And then rho, that is, which I know looks like a P, that's density. And then, just to make sure there's no confusion, P is for pressure. All right? So, let me put this in English. Pressure is related to both the height and the density of a column of liquid. And that's our first page if anyone would like to get screenshots. And if anyone has any questions before we continue, let me tell you where this story is going. And I think this is where I lost my trail a little bit this morning. We have this total pressure we're trying to relate to. We have the vapor pressure of water we already know that's involved, but we're working on this height thing. And the explanation I've just ended is to justify two things. One, why is this weight of water involved? And because weight is like a type of force. And the other thing is that it depends on what liquid that you have in the tube. So it's not just the height that's related to pressure, it's also which liquid. And that's related to a textbook problem, which, I'm sorry, I forgot to look up which number it was before class, but someone had shown me an example problem that went something like this, that the outside pressure was 745 or some random number of torr, which is millimeters of mercury. The question asked, well, what would be the equivalent in centimeters of water? And here's the point to that question, that the density of water that's equal to 1.0 grams per milliliter. The density of mercury being a metal is a lot higher. It's 13.6 grams per milliliter. Oh, someone threw me the that's problem number six, someone is telling me in the text. So, if pressure is related to weight, weight is related to density. So, since the density of mercury is 13.6 times that of water, the height of a column of water would have to be 13.6 times higher than a column of mercury in order to make up the same amount of weight. Since the density of mercury is 13.6 times that of water, the height of a column of water would have to be 13.6 times greater than a column of mercury. In order for there to be the same mass of water. And therefore related to the same pressure. So to summarize all that in English, 1 millimeter of mercury, which is the same thing as a torr, is equal to 13.6 millimeters of water. So now we can return to that original equation from the previous page. This is the one that said PT, the total pressure, is equal to the pressure of hydrogen gas plus the pressure of water plus this height difference. And now we can substitute. We could say the height of water in millimeters divided by 13.6. But of course, that means that that's going to be millimeters of mercury then. So to make this equation work out the easiest, all pressure should be calculated first in torr. So, let me just show you that De Anza website to give you an example, because we didn't actually do the lab, but in theory we would have been in lab getting the results from lab. So, one moment. Let me navigate there. And there you go. So, I will put this link into the chat window in case anybody's interested. And we can see that it's cloudy and kind of cool and kind of blah day at De Anza. And if you look a little further down on the page on the left-hand side, you can see that it says pressure 30.08 inches. And that means 30.08 inches of mercury. So suppose we really had been in lab today, and that was our pressure. All right. So this is an example. And let's say that the pressure total is equal to 30.08 inches. So we convert from inches to millimeters, and it's automatically understood that this is inches of mercury, and so it's going to become millimeters of mercury, which would be torr. So the conversion is 25.4 millimeters in 1 inch. And turns out this was the same pressure this morning. So this is 764.0 torr. Now again, this is a pressure we looked up. So the question came this morning, well, where'd you get this from? Well, I got it from the weather site. In other words, you have to be given this data somehow. So in the problem set or the data set that I send you all, it's going to have the total pressure already given to you. Vapor pressure of water, that we could just look up. We already looked that up earlier. So then we could throw everything into the equation and solve for pH2. So, in fact, I'm going to call that pH2, the pressure of hydrogen, the corrected pressure of hydrogen. And just thinking ahead, actually, we're going to call this P1. The original pressure. So this is the corrected pressure. Corrected because we take out the water and the height difference. At laboratory conditions. this morning I used a fancier term, ambient, but just meaning what is it in the lab right at that moment. Okay, so now we can get to the P1V1T1 equals P2V2T2 part. So P1V1 over T1 is equal to P2V2 over T2. And your lab write-up approaches it the same way, meaning that it calls everything that's in the one side the original measurements you make in lab, and everything on the two side what we're going to end up with STP. So in fact, let me just, that sounds like something that should be logically labeled. So here is lab, and here is STP. So P1, we already identified, that's the corrected pressure from right up above. V1, that's the eudiometer volume. That's easy. And then temperature. I'll call it reaction temperature to simplify. That's our before conditions. What are we going to end up with afterwards? Well, P2, that's STP conditions, so that means 760 torr. And notice, because it's a relationship, a proportional relationship, this equation, or maybe more easily said, because we have both, we have pressure on both sides of the equation, it doesn't matter which units we use, because the gas constant R does not show up in this expression. So, yes, that's why we can use torr. Temperature, we don't have a choice. Temperature has to be in Kelvin. So as far as the STP conditions, the lab text uses the same old set of conditions that your lecture text uses, which is 273 Kelvin, but in other words, 0 degrees Celsius. And then V2, that is what I call the adjusted volume. So I'll define that down here. V adjust is equal to the STP volume of hydrogen produced from reaction with magnesium. So in other words, we didn't use a whole mole, or we didn't produce a whole mole of gas. And so we have to later on adjust for the fact that this is the volume we want, but only for that small sample. And that's an easy fix. All we have to do is to divide by the moles that we started with. So I got disconnected. So the example. Oh, all that was is I went to, and you can see the link right up above the chat window there where you just type that in. That's a link to the De Anza weather station where I pulled off the pressure, the actual pressure right this moment. And so I was just doing an example of how you would convert that into torr if we had been in lab in real life. So doing that last calculation, actually take your screenshots, please, before I move on to the next page. Okay, then to get to that last calculation, we have to go back to the reaction equation of magnesium with hydrochloric acid. So, I might have made this point when we talked about this lab the first time. The hydrochloric acid is used in excess. So, since HCl is used in excess, Magnesium solid is the limiting reagent. Therefore, oops, I'm getting ahead of myself. Before I make my statement, let me show you it's true. There's an unwritten one, of course, in front of the magnesium, and there's an unwritten one in front of the hydrogen. So that means that the moles of hydrogen produced is equal to the moles of magnesium. So, what did I just say? Moles of hydrogen is equal to moles of magnesium, which is equal to the mass of magnesium, divided by the molar mass of magnesium. And I've been using this MM abbreviation for molar mass. So, if we take that V adjusted from up above, and we divide it by the number of moles of hydrogen gas, then that is going to be equal to the molar volume, which is the goal of the experiment. So, now that we've made it through the calculations, we need to talk about lab report format. And what I'd like to do is to bring up the syllabus here. One moment. And there. So, we're not going to worry about lab notebooks at all right now. I might want to come back and talk about it at some point. So I'm in section 6 of the syllabus, which is about lab reports. So some of you haven't had me as an instructor before. So just in case you've never heard this story, I just want to tell you where does our lab report format come from. So the most research in chemistry ends up getting spread by what's known as peer-reviewed journals. So a peer-reviewed journal is, and that's P-E-E-R for peer. That is someone that's your colleague or someone that's in the same field or someone else that's a trained scientist, maybe in a related field, but someone that still would be able to review your research. So there are all different types of journals out there. There's one known as the Journal of the American Chemical Society, JACS for short. The ACS, American Chemical Society, is a huge organization, and so they have a lot of journals themselves. There's JACS itself. There's the Journal of Organic Chemistry, the Journal of Inorganic Chemistry, the Journal of This Chemistry, the Journal of That Chemistry, all these different kinds of journals. And not just in the U.S., of course. There are lots of journals worldwide. Which, since I'm not active in research, I don't recall all of those names any longer. The only one I can remember is because I happen to go to that more frequently is Angewandte Chemie, which is a German publication that is quite widespread as well. Point being, there's all these different places you could submit your research to. And some of them are more prestigious, you could say. That, like, if you've ever heard of Nature or Science, these are journals that have flashy pictures. They're usually high-impact research. And so your research might not even necessarily be accepted by everybody. Not everybody does earth-shattering research. It might still be important, but it might be published just in a more traditional type of journal. So that's what these journals are. And the format of these articles is very detailed. Because you usually start with an abstract saying, What's the context of this research? What research was done before? To put it just bluntly, why did someone pay for you to do that research? Because to be realistic, unfortunately, nothing happens in research without funding. And so you're not just speaking to the science audience, but, and this is a real life thing to keep in mind, you're also speaking to the funders. Why was this research done? And so you'll give all the background, you'll lead up to what you want to do that's different, and then you give that exhaustive procedure where you explain every little itty-bitty detail. And then you would give all your data, you give all your calculations, graphs, everything that's relevant. And then it's not necessarily even just one conclusion statement, because your research might not be that simplistic. It might go on for some time where you're discussing all the results, and then you wrap it up into some final conclusion statement. And then there even might be some more afterwards, because often articles will say, well, what research might this lead to next? In other words, why should you still get funding? Now, obviously, this is not what we're going to be doing in this class, but that's an idea of what a peer-reviewed journal article would look like. So then, well, what format are we going to be following in lab? So we're not even going to be doing all this for the first experiment, but let me at least talk about what a more full thing would be. So obviously, you have some kind of title. An objective, that's maybe not as obvious as you think it is. Objective, yes, it's what you want to get done in the lab, but it's not necessarily what's listed in your lab manual. And what I mean by that is that the lab manual might say something like, this experiment is to learn how to, and whatever that might be. And yes, that's what your job is as a student, to learn. But that's not what the lab report's about. The lab report, in this case, is determining the molar volume of an ideal gas at STP has nothing to do with your learning process. So if I have you put an objective in, then it needs to be directly related to what your results in lab are, either the quantitative result, meaning you got a number you're reporting, or qualitative result, meaning you're looking for a color or a yes, no, or something that's just not described by numbers. But for this lab, all you're going to do is put in the last four of these things. No, I'm sorry. You're not putting procedure in because I already know it. And so there is instructors with, let's say, okay, you at least got to teach them how to do a bibliographic reference. When you need to, you'll learn it there. So I'm not worried. So it's the last three things you're going to put in. Data and calculations, the conclusion, which means what was your molar volume. And discussion in this case is going to be percent error, which I'll show you that calculation at the end here. Now, lab report formatting. Everything must be done on the computer. In other words, you cannot do your calculations by hand and then take a picture of it. It's got to be something done on the computer itself. So that means anything that's typed, any graphs, any tables, because that's just the modern world. You need to know how to produce documents in electronic format. Now, that's like a general thing. Raised hand. Sean, yes?
But even, like, mathematical equations have to be done?
No one asked that this morning, and I'll need to get back to them. No, you don't need to do those in any fancy kind of way. So if you have to, like, say, X and then the slash, like the forward or backslash, I guess that would be a forward slash, and then 13.6. If you needed to write something like that, that's fine. It doesn't need to be like print-worthy formatting. Just can't be done by hand.
Okay, like you. Okay.
And I know
a lot of math classes I've had, they don't even, because sometimes it's just like so difficult to write these things.
Nothing's going to be that complex in chemistry, not in this class. Okay. No, everything is very simple algebra. No, like you saw the calculations. So most of the calculations don't even have division signs. It's just this last one that does. And like I was saying, you can write that all out in just one line using the backslash instead of trying to come up with a fancy fraction.
Sounds good.
Now, most word processors do have equation features. And even if our equations are not complicated, it's not a waste of time to learn how to use some of those things for your future classes. But let me just look over the notes one more time to make sure I'm not imagining things. No, everything's simple enough here you could do without an equation editor. Okay. Now, one thing that's off track from that, the way that you write your report. So if you're looking at the what I'm displaying here about lab report formatting, what I'm getting at is that lab reports are normally, in chemistry at least, written in third person, meaning that we don't refer back to the researcher. It's not about the researcher. It's about the science. So, for example, we don't say things like, I measured the mass of the sample. You say the mass of the sample was measured. And it's got a real philosophical underpinning to it. Again, I'll repeat it, that if we're trying to do something objective, science, then it shouldn't matter who's put in that position, who's reading it or anything. So that's why it's written totally impersonally. At least, like I said, in chemistry. I've been told that not all fields work that way, but that's almost universally the way that chemistry works. So there's no first person like I, me, my, we, ours, us. There's no second person, you, yours, depending on which part of the country you're from, you-ins, yous, guys, how about a good y'all? You know, English needs a second person plural. One should not use the word one to somehow get around the rules and still say the you by just saying the one instead. That's not allowed. Everything's impersonal. So it's exactly what your English instructors told you not to do. English instructors are all about active constructions. I read the book. I. And no, in science, it's the reverse. It's passive. The book was read. Okay. Now, a little more about details. I used to make a big stink about the difference between data and calculations, and now I just roll it all into one section. Just to have explained an example, suppose you're measuring the mass of a liquid. Obviously, you can't take that liquid and just pour it on a balance. What we would have to do to measure that liquid then is obviously put it in a beaker or something like that, which means you've got two choices about how you can measure the mass of that liquid. You could put the beaker on the balance and hit the tear button, the zero button, so that zeroes out the balance. And then you could put the liquid in and measure it, and then that liquid would be a piece of data because it would have been directly measured. But the danger with that in a real-life lab is you might tear your beaker, pull it out, turn around and do something, and someone else has already teared it. So in order to measure the mass of a liquid then, we really need to measure the mass of the beaker and then measure the mass of the beaker and the liquid together. And of course, later on, we could subtract out that mass of the beaker from the combined mass. So that, of course, means that the mass of the liquid is no longer a piece of data. It's a calculation. So why did I used to make such a fuss about this? Well, just to understand what a calculation is, what data are, which to be really fussy about it, if you didn't know, the word data is a plural word. But, you know, there's so many situations where it makes sense to put data and calculations together. Like if you're calculating the density of a series of objects, having all those masses and the volumes all lined up with each other, that just makes sense then to put in the density as well. So as long as you do it logically, I don't matter how you put your data and calculations together. But there are some formatting things you should do for both. Everything should have a label. There should never be any number or anything that's just put out there. Everything needs to have units. If you have a volume, don't assume that I know that you're talking about milliliters. You actually need to say milliliters. Typing things like variables, even in my presentation, instead of writing out total pressure, I said PT, a logical abbreviation. So you're more than welcome to use logical abbreviations. It's just if you use something that isn't immediately obvious, you got to make sure you define that somewhere, what your variable means. Typing things. This is just to look like you know what you're doing in chemistry. If you're writing out a chemical formula like magnesium phosphate, like what I've got there, then you have to learn how to do subscripts. That means putting the text down below the level of the line. And you have to learn how to do superscripts. So, like, over here I have copper plus two. Also, your spell checkers aren't logic checkers, so you probably don't mean to tell me about your outdoor adventures. Like, you're probably not trying to tell me about trail one and trail two. You're probably trying to tell me about trial one and trial two. But both of those are perfectly good English words. Just like you're probably not worried about the morality of that solution, you're probably worried about the molarity of the solution. And I don't know why this happened. Well, I do know. In English, we say H2O. And when we say O, people think we mean zero. But there is no element zero. And yes, I'm that OCD that if you look at the page, in fact, and look where I wrote H2O with that big round O, you can see that's a slightly different shape than H20, which there is no element zero. So I guess it's just the chemist in me that's getting that one. Sean, I'm sorry. I just now noticed did you have your hand up?
Sorry.
Okay. No, just making sure. Okay. So now on to calculations. There are three things I want you to do for you each unique calculation. And like the last equation that I showed you, the molar volume. What you need to do is to write that out in some kind of word or symbol format. And even in the example I have in here is about calculating moles. So in this example in the syllabus, I have moles water is equal to mass water divided by molar mass of water. So you could do it in words or you could do it in symbols like this, but the reason I want you to do it is because maybe you'll understand the chemistry, maybe you took good data, but you don't know how to do the calculations. And sometimes when you just fill in a bunch of numbers and I don't know which equations you're using, I might not be able to follow your logic. Yes, on simpler reports I probably could, but this helps. So I see the equation you're using first, that's what I call the prototype equation. Then you do this thing I call the substituted equation, which is that you take your actual data, put it into the equation, show me your result. The reason for doing that is, what if you put the wrong pieces of data in the wrong place? Well, then I know you know how to do the calculations, but you just made a mathematical error. Now, let's say you're doing the same thing 10 times. It's a total waste of paper to just fill up pages and pages of calculations. So you should only show each unique type of calculation once. And then just tabulate all the rest of your results. And I'm going to show you the page in the lab text that will give you a guide of how maybe to set up your report. So again, you have a prototype equation where you use symbols, a substituted equation where you fill in the data, and then everything else you just tabulate. Okay, now, in this report format I just showed you, I said that there could be a discussion section. Now, I'm not opening this up to a general error discussion on this report. All I want you to do is calculate a percent error. So I'd like to just remind you of what that percent error formula is. So I know some people learned a percent error formula that has an absolute sign in it. I don't like that version, and I'll explain why. So here's what the correct equation, according to me, should be. You take whatever value you got in your experiment, so that's the obtained value, and then what the true value, or I'll say the accepted value, you subtract that from what you got. And then to give a sense of scale, you divide by that same accepted value, and then since it's a percent, you multiply by 100%. And let me write this in explicitly. Please do not use the absolute sign. In this equation. Because if your value is too high compared to what it's supposed to be, when you subtract, you'll get a positive number. And if your value is too low, when you subtract, you'll get a negative number, which means the error you get, the sign, positive or negative, automatically tells you if the error is too big or too small. Okay, so here explicitly is what you need to do. This for lab exercise one. Only data, calculations, and percent error. The part that I hope you'll be okay with is that all text tables, etc., must be in one document. Meaning, if you do something in... Oh, did it freeze again? It looks like it did. Thank you. So what I was about to say is if you did do something in a spreadsheet program and then you did something in a separate graphing program, you need to take all your different things and put them into one document. And then that will be submitted through Canvas in PDF. Which I can't remember if I said this to this section yet or not, but on a Mac, when you print, if you look at the lower left-hand corner of the diagram, it will automatically let you save anything that you're printing as a PDF file, because all graphics on a Mac were, maybe still are, generated as PDFs natively. On a PC, if it's not natively built in yet, because I don't use a PC to know, then I know there are lots of free tools out there, which if anybody has any suggestions, don't hesitate to throw me those suggestions, because I'm sure other people will need to take a look at them. I might have mentioned this in lecture, but wanted to make sure everybody knew. Now, someone's asking, do we need to attach the lab manual? No, you need to make your own report. So I'm going to show you the manual in just a moment, but you'll need to generate your own lab report. And the other important thing is that it is due on the 27th, a week from today. And that'll be for section 1, 10:30 a.m., or 10:20 a.m., when your lab is over. And then you all, section 2, that will be at 4 o'clock when your lab is over. Canvas has the ability to turn in docs, Google Doc format. Is that not accepted? I'll have to see, but that's exactly the purpose of me doing that exercise with the survey, is to get everybody used to PDF, because the grading program works best with PDFs, but I'll see if the doc will work well enough or not. No conclusion or discussion? Well, yes, you're going to calculate what your ending molar volume is, but you don't need to break out and make a separate section of it. So now, just to wrap up here with the lab, let me pull up the experiment again and just walk you through it. By the way, I have to apologize. Besides the interruptions, I know this morning, I didn't realize it till this afternoon, I didn't give them a break. So I may go just a few minutes over. Or you know what? No, I'll do that for next time. If you turn to the end of your experiment, there is a data table here, which again, you cannot just print the table and fill it out and turn that in. You need to generate your own report. And yes, I'm going to be emailing you all out the set of data to use. But I just want to walk through this and match it up with what we discussed in our own lab lecture, because there are some very small differences that I want to point out. So at the beginning here, we have the mass of magnesium, then the volume of hydrogen gas, which are the two things you're going to directly measure. Oh, that's your data table. I'm sorry, let me go to the calculations table. There we go. So in the calculations, it has you fill in some of the data here, and that's why I said it might make sense to combine your data and calculations together. If you take the mass of the magnesium, then it has you put in the molar mass. So if you divide the two, of course, you're going to get the moles of magnesium. That's what we'll need at the very end to get molar volume. Moles of hydrogen gas, that's equal to the moles of magnesium. That's why we had that discussion of stoichiometry. And then temperature and volume here, these are directly measured. So temperature would be what we measured right outside the solution. And then volume, that would be the volume of the gas in the eudiometer. Barometric pressure, that's the total pressure, which I'm going to have to give you that in your data set. The vapor pressure of water, you can get that from the equation or from a table. And then the thing that's missing, so if you're looking at the screen here, right where my cursor is, there's a line missing. Because the way that the lab does the calculations, it does not include that adjustment for height. But we do need to keep that adjustment for height because that's the way that we would have run the lab in real life in my section. And it's not the common case that the height of the liquid just magically ends up correct. So there is one other adjustment that's not in here. So when you use equation 4, remember, use the equation from the lab notes, not the one in the lab text. The volume of hydrogen at STP, that's what I call the adjusted volume. That's V2. And then we divide by the number of moles in that last step in order to come up with the molar volume. Now, the accepted value is 22.4 liters. You can find that in your textbook. And so when you do percent error, you'll use that value from the text. But maybe I'll put it in the lab here, just so that we got it in one reference place. So let me share this one last time here. Okay. So I'll put in here the accepted value, is 22.4 liters. And that's it for this lab exercise, otherwise known as a lab report. Any questions about the report at all? Since it's not due till Monday, that means you've got a chance before Wednesday to try to start on it and then ask your questions.
When will you be sending out the data?
Probably in the next hour or two. I'm going to try to do it before my next class here.
Sounds good.
I do have this other hot potato with the department I need to take care of first, but then I'll try to get that data out as soon as I can.
Did you do the experiment, out of curiosity?
I couldn't. I asked if I could go to campus, and besides that, it violating the intent of the stay-at-home, they don't want anybody on campus that's not there for truly official work. So I wasn't able to do it my own self. So, and I was going to video it and show it to you all and be all fancy like that, but the dean said, very nice idea. Absolutely not.
So is this just made up data?
No, well, I see what you're asking. No, I believe this was, because I don't have my notebooks with me, Professor Muzzi was nice enough to pass me along past data from past students.
Okay.
So I did not personally do this set of data, no.
Okay.